This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Summer months are a time for outdoor fun for many of us and for our pets. But fleas and ticks are out in force now, too, and protecting our furry friends from infestation can also protect their human families. Today, we're going to talk about the best ways to keep dogs and cats safe outside, tips for taking cats out on leashes, and how to reduce pets' fears when neighbors start setting off noisy summer fireworks. It's The Pet Show and your questions for the full hour. Joining me today are University of Cincinnati Blue Ash College Veterinary Technology Program Director, Dr. Jennifer Wells, DMV. Welcome back, Dr. Wells.
Hi. Good to be here.
Great to have you. Dog Abilities owner and trainer, Day Groton. Thanks for being here, Day.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
And Patience for Cats founder and associate certified cat behavior consultant, Patience Fisher. Welcome back, Patience.
Nice to be here.
Great to have you all. The University of Cincinnati is a financial supporter of Cincinnati Public Radio. Our experts are here to answer your questions, so give us a call at 513-419-7100 or send us an email at talk@wvxu.org. Dr. Wells, I want to start with you. It's that time of year where, as I said, we're spending more time outside. So are lots of our pets. What are your recommendations for flea and tick prevention? And are there natural treatments without the pesticides that are in those topical treatments that so many people use, natural treatments that actually work?
I would say that I don't know of any what I would call natural treatments that actually work well. Mm. The nice part is if somebody has an aversion to putting a topical treatment on, especially for your dogs, there are oral treatments now that work super well. There actually are some that work for multiple months in a row. And in the area that we live in our climate, you know, it's maybe not ticks, but certainly fleas can survive throughout the winter. And so as a veterinarian, we generally recommend that your animal stays, dog or cat, but especially our dogs that go outside more frequently, stay on flea and tick prevention year round. Just makes it much more easy to prevent any infestations in your house. And you're not going to forget to start them back on when we have those really nice warm days in March, for example. So I would certainly recommend using, we've got really good safety data on all those products, and I've seen too many people who have tried natural products that just don't work well, and they really have, some really bad infestations in their houses that they need to get rid of.
Yeah. Well, and I was reading up and it talked about, you know, bathing your pets and doing those things, which I can be easier with some pets than others.
Absolutely. And you know, bathing certainly can help remove the adult fleas that are on the animal, but they're not going to prevent any of the, you know, fleas from getting back on or larval stages that are in the environment from getting back on the animal. So it's not going to give them that protection that they need when they're going back out into the environment.
Yeah, well, and to continue on the nasty pest question, what about worms? How can we avoid worms for our cats and dogs?
Absolutely. And worms are really important. We don't like to think about them, but they're super important because we do have some zoonotic diseases which can get transmitted to people. Even with ticks, which you mentioned before, you know, they can transmit Lyme disease to us or obviously our children. But we also have some of those nasty worms like roundworm and hookworm that live in the soil. The nice part about some of those products I already mentioned, they have actually can come with everything all in one. But another worm we don't think about that animals should be protected against every month is heartworm. Mm. Heartworm is actually carried by mosquitoes. And again, we think about those as being, you know, spring, summer, fall creatures, insects, but they can be around year-round. So we do recommend that our dogs and even cats can be on heartworm prevention year-round. And most heartworm preventatives also have those dewormers in them that also get those zoonotic parasites as well.
Gotcha. So do it all. Take care of it all at once.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm very fortunate. I have a Labrador, so he loves getting his little treat once a month, and he enjoys that. Now, if you have a smaller dog or a dog that doesn't appreciate the flavor of those little flavored chews, there are topical products you could use for to prevent all of those different diseases as well. But as you mentioned, some people don't like that residue or whatever that might be on the coat. So I would say talk to your veterinarian. There's a huge variety of products out there now that are proven safe and effective.
Okay. Day, I have a question for you that came from our news director, Marianne Zalesnik. She asks, how do you stop a dog from barking whenever anyone walks past the house on the sidewalk or when a delivery truck goes by?
Yeah, so I will say that that's a really common issue that we see in a lot of pet homes. I mean, dogs are like, this is my house. You know, I see somebody coming towards my house. I need to protect it a little bit. So it is very common. But there are ways that we can actually work on reducing that barking, in a sense. So one way I like to do it was with simple management. So something like window film. A lot of people don't really know a lot about window film, but I would say in the last several years at least, it's gotten a little bit more popular. And nowadays, window film can look really nice. It just, you know, there are all different patterns and designs with it. And it tends to help mute, like, the visual for the dog as well as the sound. So that's one way that might work on it. You can always do blinds, too. That would be another option. But dogs do, you know, they get pretty, they know, and so they will easily put their head, you know, under the blind, or they may destroy the blind or something like that.
Yeah.
Other things I do when I am there physically is when I see a dog or a person walk by their house, I will start to reward my dog. So the idea being that the people and the dog start to predict something good to your dog. Mm. I get rewarded for that. And then over time, what happens, the dogs are able to just look at those things go by or hear those things go by and not have to react so much with barking and lunging and all of that. I will say in general, a little barking I think is okay, but we need to be able to stop the barking. And when I do that too, I can also teach the dog a word that means that I saw that person or dog, you have told me, you've done your job, but now I need you to just, you know, stop barking. And so, and again, I do it through rewards with the word, so they start to understand that that word might be quiet or enough or thank you. That's a good one to use. And then they start to get rewarded for it.
Okay.
So those would be a couple techniques that I would use for that problem.
And when you're starting with those treats, is it important to give the treat before the barking starts so the treat doesn't seem like a reward for the barking?
Yeah, I definitely want to try to catch the dog when they see that visual or hear the thing before the barking starts. So if you can do that, that's definitely helpful. Now, if that doesn't happen, like you do get a little barking, it's not going to be the end of the world. But you do want to learn to manage it. It might be with some distance, creating distance with that or something like that. But if you can catch it before, that's going to be your best option.
Okay. Patience, I have a question for you. One of our producers has a cat who loves to go outside on a leash. That is a miracle because I don't have a lot of cats who have loved that. I mean, I have one who liked it for a while. What can you do to make cats more comfortable on leashes? Are there step-by-step techniques you can use to kind of get your cat accustomed to that?
Yeah, you have to, first of all, train them in the house so that they are comfortable with the harness first before you put on the leash. So on my webpage, patientsforcats.com, I have a blog on harness training your cat just for inside purposes. And the leash comes after they're comfortable with the harness. And of course, we do it with rewards. We do it slowly. When you first start with the harness, you know, put down a treat that the in the neck piece, so they put their head in and they get rewarded for that. And then after, you know, a few sessions like that, you can pull it up a little bit just off the floor because that kind of spooks them sometimes. And very gradually, you know, you pull it on and then you give them a second treat, pull it right off. So you go very, very slowly. And for each step, we want to be very cognizant of the body language that they're not upset. So better off going too slow than too fast for these kind of things. So once, you know, they're comfortable with the harness, the next step is the leash. The important thing to know about the leash for a cat, more so than a dog, is you want a tiny bit of contact on it so they're aware it's there. So sometimes they'll go back so it's loose and then lunge forward and then get a big jerk on the leash that they did themselves. But it's still, it's aversive and you don't want that. So you want to keep, I use two hands, one to hold the back of the leash, one closer to the cat. So I can use the second hand that's closer just to keep up the slack. So they know that that leash is there. So if they start moving backwards, you know, I tighten it a little so they still feel it. So they can't give themselves that jerk feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Hold it at a 90 degree angle to their back. You know, the leash looks so much like their cat toys. So some of them will roll over and start playing with it. So that can be an issue. And there's ways to train them not to do that. But the most important thing is, you know, very short and hold it that way. They start to play with it, I take it off. So, you know, they quickly learn that's not going to happen. Now, when you're going to start to go outside, one thing that I really recommend is that you put them in their carrier to carry them through the door. Now, this is because cats are quick and cats are good at hiding. They'll be hiding under the sofa and darting out that door if they really love the outdoors. So if they've never walked through the door, they just get carried out the door. That really helps avoid that dangerous situation. And you can leave the carrier out and they want to ask to go outside. They go in their carrier. That's good and safe. So darting out the door. Then you have to be careful where you take your cat. You know, cats tend to startle easily. I would not take a cat outside that hasn't been desensitized to anything they might see in that environment. And I would keep them in an environment that you have good control of, especially in the beginning, till you know what they're comfortable with. And have that carrier right there, because if they're afraid, they want a hiding place. And if it's there and open, that's a better place to go than running, you know, up a tree or take it off into the neighbor's yard.
Yeah. These are great windows into the psyches of cats. I really appreciate this. Are there particular breeds of cats that do better walking on a leash than others?
There probably are, but most of my clients are mixed breeds. So I don't have enough. Most of my clients don't walk on leashes. I've had some that did, but I don't have enough, you know, data there to tell you that I've seen so many of this breed do it. Gotcha. What you really want is a cat that's bold, a cat that not afraid of children, not afraid of noises, not afraid of bicycles, not afraid of car might backfire, horn might beep, you know, things that might happen. Cat that's when weird things happen in your home, they're like, wow, what's that? Let me explore. You know, so you want to do a lot of desensitizing in your home, windows open, you can have things happen outside, things you can bring into the house, little noises or whatnot, just, you know, those bold cats, they do much better.
That makes more so than the scaredy cats, I'm sure.
Yeah, that's just such a dangerous situation, and they're not likely to enjoy it either. For those cats, I would recommend a catio or a screened-in porch. They can get that, you know, fresh air coming right at them, and the sounds and the smells. But you know, they're safe with the screen. Now, I wouldn't leave them there, you know, while you're not at home, because the screen's not a complete, you know, protection. But you know, they can enjoy that when you're home and doing other things. You can spot check them.
Yeah. What about a cat tent?
Yeah, same thing. As long as you're either with them or you're, you know, keeping an eye on them, because, you know, some outdoor animal could get in there or could, you know, become unsecure or something could frighten them. You don't want them there frightened for a long time. So that's just a consideration. And it just depends on, you know, your neighborhood and if you have a fence yard, if it's got a quiet time of day where you're not going to be worrying about, and depending on where you live, you know, fireworks or horns blowing or someone having target practice, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, we're going to get to those loud noises a little bit later on the program. Dr. Wells, what extra shots, if any, should cats get if they're going to be spending time outside on a leash?
That's a great question. There certainly are core vaccines that we recommend for all cats, whether they're inside or outside, but there are some extra vaccines that cats might be more at risk at coming in contact specifically with other cats. So if a cat's living at home in its environment with its family of cats or dogs, it's not at risk to come in contact with a feral cat or, you know, cats that are living outside. But if it's going outside, even if it's expected to be protected by its owner. But certainly if it's going out unaccompanied, we know that there's a chance that it's going to come in contact with a cat that's living outside, whether it's a friendly cat or not. And they're more at risk at coming in contact with mostly our retroviruses like FIV and FELV. Some of those we can vaccinate for and some of those we cannot. So I would certainly recommend having a discussion with your veterinarian to make sure that they're up to date on all vaccines. Certainly the core vaccines and rabies is always important. But leukemia, for example, would be one that might not be required for a cat that lives inside with his, you know, core family. But for a cat that goes outside, might come in contact with a cat that carries leukemia, that would be important.
Yeah. We got a couple of questions related to our earlier discussion about flea and tick remedies. One listener emailed, what's the best way to remove a tick? Manually, chemically? Like, what do you recommend?
Yeah, really what the parasitology folks recommend is probably putting gloves on, because any of the fluids that come out of a tick, especially if it's engorged, which sounds disgusting, could have some of those communicable diseases in it. So putting on gloves is important, or certainly washing your hands after you've handled a tick. And then if you have tweezers or want to use tweezers, you could do that. I'm kind of a country girl at heart, lived born on the farm. I just handle it with my hands, and I feel like I can get right down near the animal's skin as close as I can. And the important thing is you don't want to do it real abruptly. You have to kind of have a slow and steady pressure. There's a little bit of a fallacy out there that you're going to leave the head or the teeth behind, or, you know, the mouth parts behind. That's not really true, but what you want to slowly disengage the tick from the animal's body, or from the, you know, the dog's skin or the cat's skin. Mm-hmm. So just some slow and steady pressure should allow it to disengage. And then you need to make sure that you kill it after you take it off, because if you just fling it out into the yard, it's just going to jump on another creature. Again, being from the country, and honestly, in the vet clinic, we used to have these little jars of alcohol, mm-hmm. and you just dump them in there and that'll kill them. Okay. You know, it's they're pretty hard to kill.
Yeah.
So that'll take care of them and, you know, keep them from jumping back on another creature.
Yeah. I wasn't exactly from the country, but I had cousins who swore you had to burn them, which
yeah.
is like,
I terrible. Mean, if you're into that kind of thing, I guess you could do that. I would yeah. probably take care of them as well.
Yeah,
I won't mention things that we used to do to them in the
yeah,
country, but,
right.
but yeah, that slow and steady pressure, making sure that you don't get the fluids on you, and wash your hands after you've removed one. But that's
yeah.
a great question.
Yeah, I feel like my cousin just wanted to burn something. That
yeah.
might have been what was going on. We do have another question from Barbara. Barbara emailed, there are FDA warnings about severe toxic side effects of oral flea treatments. Please address those.
Sure. Yeah, that's a great question. And again, this is another question that you would want to bring up with your veterinarian. Most of those that are linked to the feet of the oral flea and tick products have to do with dogs that are have any history of epilepsy, because some of the newer products that are, you know, really great don't work for all patients. And so this, again, is a and this is why they're FDA approved, and this is why they're only available for your veterinarian, is because it has to be a medical decision about what's best for your pet. If that product is not going to work for your pet, there are some, I don't want to use the word older product, mm-hmm. because they're still great products, but there are still other products out there that are FDA approved and still very effective that are not going to potentially have those negative side effects.
Okay. Well, we will continue talking pets in just a moment. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're talking about pets today for the full hour. My guests are University of Cincinnati Blue Ash College Veterinary Technology Program Director Dr. Jennifer Wells, DMV, Dog Abilities owner and trainer, Dae Groden, and Patients for Cats founder and associate certified cat behavior consultant, Patience Fisher. They are ready to answer your questions about your pets. The number to call is 513-419-7100, or you can email talk at wvxu.org. Patience, we had a call from Peter who didn't want to go on the air, but Peter said, I had to put down one of my cats. I have one cat left and she's 7. I fear she's getting lonesome. Should I get her an older cat or a younger cat as a companion? Which would be more compatible with her? What are your thoughts on that, Patience?
Yeah, that's always a tough one. Yeah, I'm sorry for your loss. That's always tough when you know, a cat loses their buddy, especially such a young age at seven.
Yeah.
That's a tricky age because they're pretty set in their ways at seven. You know, I would liken that to maybe a 50-year-old person, and they've only had the one friend their whole life. If he's saying that, if that's what I'm hearing, that he hasn't been with a bunch of other cats. Just because she was close to the one she lost doesn't mean she's going to want any replacement. So that's, you know, just like people, you might love your spouse, but not necessarily want to remarry if you lose them. And, you know, just randomly picking one, that can be tough. That said, if he feels really strongly about getting another cat, I would go kind of in between. The older cats, as I said, they're set in their ways. And unless you can find one that has been with tons of cats and loves every cat, it's just harder to find the, you know, they're less flexible. The younger ones, they're just so active. And even if your seven-year-old's active now, she probably won't be when she's 10. Whereas a kitten, yeah, at a three-year-old, yeah, they're still pretty lively.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, so if you were going to do it, I would, you know, really want to know the personality of the cat. And you might want to consider fostering a cat and see how that goes. Now, trouble with that, you don't have a lot of choice. You know, usually the ones that they're going to have you foster are going to be ones with behavioral issues or health issues. But some of the behavioral issues are just related to like shelter shock. You need to keep them apart, whether you foster or, you know, adopt a cat that's, you know, maybe 3 to 5 years old. But most importantly, somebody that grew up with cats, has been with cats their whole life, and it's just really easygoing. And then you do a very slow introduction. Again, if you go to my webpage, patientsforcats.com, I have some of the general steps for introducing cats using my technique. It does not recommend feeding them next to each other or having them close to each other at all. That often causes more problems than it solves. It helps with some cats, but with some cats, it really backfires. So I have a different technique. You can see the outline to that on my webpage.
Are there other ways to help lonely pets other than getting another pet? I mean, if Peter's cat is 7 years old, he can kind of sense that she's being lonesome. Are there other strategies other than another
cat? Yes. A lot of it depends on, you know, how, I don't know how long ago. Did he say how long ago the friend cat passed?
No, he did not.
Okay. Because there is a period of mourning. And, you know, if it's only been, you know, a few days or a few weeks, you know, you definitely don't want to get anything new into, you know, her life. She needs her time to just, you know, regroup. And, you know, at that point, you know, just, it seems counterintuitive, but giving her more places to hide, more cushy, soft places to sleep, just so she can, you know, self-soothe. One thing that's really nice for cats her age, whether they're in mourning or not, is a self-heating cat bed. These are marketed for outdoor cats because you don't have to plug them in, but this makes it so much safer. So it's basically a piece of reflective foil wrapped in fleece. And, you know, cats just love being warm. It just helps her relax. You know, she's probably tense from, you know, the big change in her life. So just helping her relax. And when she's, you know, sleeping and, you know, she's under so much stress. When you're under stress, you generally need more sleep. So that is helpful. And, you know, I would say, you know, a quieter household, you know, I wouldn't be having any parties if possible. I wouldn't want to be traveling big distances, but you know, that would be even more so if you were to get another cat. You want to make sure you're home for several months because, you know, it can take a long time and it doesn't always work either. You have to have a plan B where, okay, I have to swap these guys out, and keep them separated indefinitely. Mm. So it is a risk, but if it's, you know, only been a few weeks or a few months, like I definitely would not get a replacement Well, that's a bad word. I wouldn't get a another cat, you know, for at least 6 months after she's, you know, lost her friend.
Yeah.
And time with you. I mean, I imagine since you're so concerned about her, I imagine you have a very good bond with her. Mm-hmm. So you can arrange to have more time with her. I'm sure that she would like that.
Dave, what about dogs? I know so many people have dogs that have been buddies for years and kind of, you know, been roommates and friends for a long time. And when one is lost, is your advice similar to patients' advice for cats?
Yeah, it is similar. I think dogs, you know, there are definitely dogs who do mourn their, you know, their housemate and things like that. Other dogs who seem to, maybe the word would be accept it, maybe a little easier, and tend to kind of go on with their normal routines. I tell clients if they have a dog who is a little depressed or is concerned, some of them definitely ask me about, you know, should I get a companion, a puppy, should I get another dog? And that's always a it depends question because, you know, some of the dogs, you know, actually might like being an only dog or at least being yeah. that way for a while. But I do tell clients a lot of times, especially during that period right after they've lost their housemate, you know, spend time with their dogs. Do things that they enjoy to do together. You know, make your routines normal in a sense. Because we know dogs and other animals will definitely also feel what you're feeling too. So as we are also mourning, you know, we have to do similar things that we would be doing with our pets too. So dogs, our animals definitely do mourn. They definitely can have a hard time with it, but they can also get past it just like we can.
We got a call from Angela. Angela said, our neighbors are feeding feral cats. What should we do about that? Do you have any advice? She is looking for the neighbors to stop this. She doesn't think it's a great thing to do. Dr. Wells, I'll start with you. You're nodding your head.
Yeah, that's a very common practice in different areas of the city. And, you know, honestly, it's probably someone who's lonely and, you know, sees animals in need and is trying to help them. It does create a bit of a problem, and it can be a nuisance for others in the neighborhood. It creates a bit of a dynamic there with your neighbor, and it can be difficult to manage that. That's a whole different show. Neighbors and angry
show.
Neighbors.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. But there are organizations out there that can help make sure those cats are taken care of. In other words, are these kittens or young animals that need to be neutered and spayed so that they aren't populating the area? Could they be trapped and taken somewhere for adoption or taken to someplace that's safer for them than living in a neighborhood? Are they truly feral or are they just cats that belong to somebody and they're not keeping them in their house appropriately? Maybe it's worth a conversation with that person, and maybe this person has already had that conversation and they know that they're just feeding them because they feel sorry for them, and maybe suggesting some of those alternatives. Some of our local spay-neuter clinics like Ohio Alley Cat Resource is a great resource for these types of situations. And you can, which is right up the street here, spay-neuter resource, they may have some resources that they could provide this person to either get the animals spayed-neutered, sometimes even for free, and or provide resources to find those cats' homes since they may not be taken care of appropriately.
Right. I know there are several organizations locally that do the trap, neuter, release.
Absolutely.
This is for neighborhoods that are okay with having cat colonies in them, but you can tell their ears have been tipped, you know, the little bit of the ear is removed after they've been, so you know they've already been spayed or neutered.
Yeah. And there has been a lot of research that shows that for, you know, these colonies, if you get them spayed and neutered, you know, they test them to make sure they don't have any of those retroviruses. They actually have like a stable population there. If you remove all of those cats, it's just going to refill with another group of cats. And so there is some research that shows that, you know, if somebody's willing to feed them and if people are willing to have that small group of cats there, if we take care of them and get them fixed so that the population doesn't explode, that's you know, obviously not the ideal situation, but there's hundreds of animals living outside. So it's better than the alternative. So I think it warrants a conversation about, you know, are these animals, you know, ones that need to be fixed, or is there resources that maybe we can provide for this person to help them find a place for these animals?
Mm-hmm. Okay, Day, I want to talk to you about dog parks. And I know we talked during the break, you and Dr. Wells both have some strong feelings about dog parks, which is great. Can you kind of talk with us about the pros and cons of dog parks? Are they a place where you can go to socialize an anxious dog? Or is that a good idea, terrible idea? What's your take on dog parks?
Yeah, so I will say if you ask a lot of trainers and other vet professionals and things like that, when we think about dog parks, sometimes we do cringe a little bit. I look at dog parks as a little bit, it's definitely kind of a consumer beware type of thing. There are definitely pros and cons. I think the biggest kind of misconception that I get with my clients, and I think the general public, is they think the dog park is a place to go to socialize their pet. And really, dog parks should be a place for dogs who are already socialized. They get along with dogs, they're friendly with other dogs and other people. And honestly, from just kind of a general standpoint, a lot of dogs aren't what we call like dog park dogs. That they're like the type of dog who, you know, they don't care if there's like another dog who might get in their face or something. They just tend to be a lot more tolerant of other dogs. Because we have dogs who they just are not, you know, or we have dogs who really like the friends that they know versus random strange dogs that they're just not comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you've got to definitely look at that. I definitely say no puppies at dog parks. And I know Dr. Wells will get into some reasons on that too. Because, you know, during that puppy phase, there is, you know, puppies are kind of like sponges and they take in a lot of information. And so every experience they have can be positive or negative or things like that. And there's just a little too much risk at a dog park where it can be a negative experience. So that's how, kind of my general take about socialization aspect, kind of things like that. Now, with that said, because we do know people want to take their dogs to dog parks or maybe meet with friends at dog parks or things like that. So a couple kind of just quick tips that I will tell people that they should do. This is what I also tell my clients as well. So if you're going to go to a dog park, okay, number one, you really need to know dog body language, okay? And the nice thing is we have a lot of resources for learning about dog body language. I'll just give a quick plug out to Lily Chin. She's a dog illustrator. She has a couple books out on dog body language. She does an excellent job of just lots of different ways that your dog is showing different dog behavior. IAABC.org also has some really great visuals on dog park, like things that you should look for. And they have downloadable graphics that you can see that also Lily Chin did do. So that's what I would say. Really understand dog body language because it's just going to help you with your own dog as well as other dogs that you're seeing out there. Secondly, watch your dog. Okay, that's a really big one. You know, don't be on your phone all the time. Don't be talking to someone else. Watch your dog. And if you see your dog doing kind of an inappropriate behavior, you know, go get your dog or intervene. Okay. Third thing I would say that I think is really, really important is have a recall with your dog, meaning have, you know, when you call your dog that they're going to come back. And it's definitely hard at a dog park because if your dog is playing, I mean, why would they really want to come back to you? Okay? Because
sounds like your little kids at a park.
Exactly. Because a lot of times we call them and then we kind of leash them up and we go away. So there's definitely ways to work on that in terms of building a better recall and where they don't view it as like, I'm just going to go home type of thing. So those are kind of the really big three things that I tell people about if they're going to go to a dog park. Definitely if they see something going on, like their dog might be afraid, another dog might be bullying their dog or something like that, you should leave. Mm. Don't keep your dog there. Just, you know, go up and leave. If you do have friends who your dogs have already met, they're friendly, they get along, and you want to meet at a dog park and, like, play and things like that, I think that is totally fine to do. It's very appropriate. Just know that if you have, like, another dog that may come in, that can definitely set the dog dynamics off And so it may be a good time to leave, you know, if things are occurring that should not be occurring. Mm. So those are kind of my, I will say, quick rundown about dog parks, because it is a topic that you can talk about it quite a bit.
Yeah. We have a caller on the line. Sandy, thank you so much for calling. What's your question or comment?
Hi, thank you. My dog is almost 5 years old, and about 3.5 years ago, unfortunately, she ran up to another dog in my neighborhood and got beat up. And she wasn't injured, but the dog had her on her back, and she was pretty traumatized by that. And she does not forget. And now, even when I see another dog who might have growled at her at one point, she does not forget that dog, and she just gets very upset and starts, like, panting and almost like grunting in a very strange way whenever she smells that dog or those dogs around. And when we see the dog, she just goes crazy. She just gets very, very upset, barking and growling and carrying on. So I would like some tips about what to do to help her deal with that.
I'm
so sorry about your dog being attacked by another dog, because that definitely can cause your dog to be worried and concerned when they see other dogs. Things that we kind of do to kind of help those behaviors is I want to try to what we call counter condition. So the idea being that when they do see another dog, it's going to predict something good. So it may be a treat reward, it may be play, it may be distance, actually just giving more distance. And whenever I'm working on counter conditioning to other dogs, or it might be even people or anything that the dog is triggered by, I'm going to use distance. I'm going to find a distance the dog can handle just even looking at that dog and not reacting or barking or things like that. Because a lot of times what we're wanting to do with that is we're not only wanting to change the emotional response, because it is an emotional feeling of how they feel towards the dog, but also we want to teach them a more appropriate behavior to do. So it may be looking at you instead. I might just do something simple like finding treats on the ground. You know, maybe playing with you with a tug toy, or if they like that, or something like that. But the biggest thing I can say is that really does take time. It's not something that is overnight and things like that. But distance is your friend. Finding some motivations that your dog will work for is a good thing. If you can do setups with dogs who are who your dog might not care about at the very beginning, you start to do that because then they're not triggered so much by a dog that they may not know. So I can start there and then build up with dogs that the dog doesn't know. I will always say it can get better. Your dog may never be the type who's going to be like super social, you know, towards another dog in terms of like a social butterfly. But it can get better in terms of if you can manage it, they can feel better about seeing other dogs so they can cope with it. And that's really, I think, the biggest thing you really want. We also want to make it where your dog feels safe in terms of you are going to advocate for your dog as well. I think that's a really big component to dogs who are worried about other dogs.
Yeah. Thanks so much for your call, Sandy. I sure hope that helps. Okay. I hope things get better with your dog.
Well, it's not exactly the situation, though. She is friendly with other dogs, but if I have her on leash and I'm walking and a dog has growled at her maybe 6 months ago, she does not forget that.
Gotcha. She kind of holds a grudge.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So
right.
It's going to...
And, of course, the dog that beat her up, she does definitely hold a grudge against that dog.
Right. But, and
it doesn't happen with all dogs.
Right. Yeah, and it's going to be the same techniques that we're going to use, because we definitely have dogs who are only reactive on leash versus off-leash and things like that. But I'm going to use the same principles. I'm going to use distance as my friend. I'm going to start to predict good things when your dog sees that dog. And with the dog who attacked her, she may never feel completely okay. It's kind of like people. I mean, we don't always love every person, right? But I do want to make it better where, again, she can kind of cope with it, and I'm giving her some other options she can do than to feel worried and get rewarded for an inappropriate behavior.
Thanks so much, Sandy. I hope it gets better. We're going to have to move on. We've got some other questions here. Jen, who works here at WVXU, asks, how can I tell when my dog is done with a walk in the summer heat? I know better than to take him out in the blazing sun, so we usually walk him early morning and late evening. He's a black short-haired 3-year-old super mutt who starts panting pretty quickly when it's hot or humid out, but he also needs the exercise. Any advice? Dr. Wells, you have advice about that?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I think heat exhaustion or heat stroke is a huge issue in summer. And so I was hoping this would come up. We all know, not to exercise your dog. Well, I hope we all know not to exercise your dog in the middle of summer. So I'm glad that she mentioned that already. Don't leave your dog in a hot car unattended, all that kind of stuff. We do need to be really conscious of how the dog is behaving. And this sounds like a really conscientious owner who probably walks their dog every day, just like I walk my dog every day. And so I'm just going to kind of more go off of my dog ownership and maybe not as much about my vet skill here, but really just kind of paying attention to how quickly the dog is moving. I think our dogs are really good at showing us at when they're starting to get more tired. My dog, unfortunately, is a puller, so I probably need to talk to Dave after this to make him not pull. But I notice when it's warm out that, yeah, they start panting right away. That's a very common thing. And but he will slow down and start walking more slowly earlier in his walk. So, you know, if we walk 2 miles every day, whether it's hot or cold, I can tell that when it's warm, number one, we're walking more slowly. And number two, he might tire more towards a mile or even sooner than that. And so I know that I need to walk more slowly and maybe turn around or, you know, make our loop a little bit shorter. You really just need to watch. If he's, you know, acting like he's really panting hard, like he's just been running laps versus just kind of taking a little amble around the block, I think cutting it short is going to be the most healthy decision for them, because they really can't sweat the way humans can. And so panting is their only method of cooling and, you know, a little bit through their pads. And so we have to be really conscientious for them.
Yeah. We've got a lot more to talk about, but we're going to take a quick break and be right back. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're in the final stretch of today's pet show, and our experts are ready to answer your questions. My guests are University of Cincinnati Blue Ash College Veterinary Technology Program Director, Dr. Jennifer Wells, DVM, Dogabilities owner and trainer, Dave Roden, and Patients for Cats founder and Associate Certified Cat Behavior Consultant, Patience Fisher. Give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. This hour has just flown by. We do have some questions that folks have emailed in. Alex emails, I have a 12-year-old adopted dachshund who is quite docile and friendly to all. I've had him and his companion about a year. One big problem I have is that he cries, howls, or at best whines constantly when I take him on a drive in the car. He's very excited to get into the car when we start. It goes berserk and literally flies out when we stop. In between, during the movement, he cries, howls, and whines. He has a companion female, 10 years old, totally different personality, who seems just fine with the whole thing. She whines too, but only after he's been vocalizing for some time. Both love going for a park walk like in Sharon Woods, but the drive is a challenge. Any suggestions?
I get a lot of questions about car behaviors in with our dogs. There are some dogs who absolutely love the car and other dogs who kind of dread the car, or they are excited to go somewhere, but they don't really like the car itself. So it is definitely, there are dogs who have some anxiety with it, kind of related to it. I will say it's a bit of problem solving, so kind of a couple tips that might help. Some things I try to do is maybe like change something in terms of where the dog is in the car. I don't know what the setup is with your dachshunds right now, but, you know, sometimes having some type of carrier, sometimes having it where, you know, the wind is blowing in their face, they feel better. Some dogs, I even have them in a footwell with a dog bed. You know, they just feel a little more secure. If the dog will take treats in the car, I will start to reward them for being in the car and being calm, just being calm in the car. Car may not even be turned on at all. But starting there, and then once I, you know, start the car again, that they're going to be calm and I can reward them for that. So I think it's just kind of trying some different, you know, techniques and things that might work with your dog and just seeing what will or will not work. Because it is, I think sometimes with the car stuff, it is a little trial and error and trying to figure out exactly, you know, pinpointing exactly what issue the dog is having with the car itself. Because there really are a lot of different reasons for why the dog may be anxious about the car and things like that.
Yeah. We had another email. This one's from Kathy. Kathy writes, my dog had a reaction to an oral flea treatment, Simparica. He's a 22-pound border collie mix. For a month after the flea treatment, he could not control his hind legs and would fall and stumble. I made a complaint to the company and FDA. This medicine worked great until it made him sick. Now I have his hair cut very short of the groomer's in April or so, and I try to get rid of any fleas I see immediately by hand. I don't want to give him medicine anymore. Have you had that happen with patients, Dr. Wells?
I have not had that happen, and I'm glad that she contacted the company because certainly these products come onto the market, and certain animals have individual responses to them. And so the company needs to know if an animal's had a problem. And sometimes, in very rare cases, products come back off the market because they've had too many negative responses. So I think I'm very upset and, you know, feel badly that her dog had that response, and hopefully they're okay now. I think there are other ways to manage external parasites. It's hard on dogs because they do go outside to go to the bathroom. But hopefully she's living in an area where they're not encountering very many fleas. There are some, you know, shorter term flea medications, even things like bathing, you know, can remove the external fleas that are on there. And if there aren't any fleas in her immediate environment, that can be enough for that particular animal. There are other products that are not related to some of their newer products, like Simparica that she mentioned, or some of the newer products that might be safer for her animal, but I can understand that she might just not want to give anything. One of my mom's dogs had a reaction at one point, and she's like, nope, no more for that dog. And she found other ways to make sure her dog was as healthy as possible, not using that particular type of medication. I can certainly sympathize with that. So she can work with her veterinarian and make sure that, you know, she's covering other bases, but not using that type of a medication. Mm.
This hour has gone so quickly. We're running out of time. Patience, we have less than a minute left, so it's not fair to ask you this, but we did say we'd talk about fireworks. What are some of the tips and tricks that you can do, or is it a matter of giving cats more hiding places when you know fireworks or thunderstorms and these loud, scary sounds might freak them out?
Yes, I would shut them in a room that they're comfortable with. I would have, you know, it's good for a cat to have a room that they're comfortable in, that has a, you know, comfortable bed, and you know, you sort of see where they like to hang out during the day or at night, because I know my cats like to be downstairs during the day and it's an open floor plan, so that wouldn't be ideal. But you could have it as that. You just want to be with them. You want to give them a lot of hiding places, you know, boxes turned upside down and with a opening, not that they necessarily jump in, but that they tunnel in.
Yeah.
Give them lots of choices.
Okay. We will have to leave it there. I wish we had 2 hours for the pet show. I've been talking with University of Cincinnati Blue Ash College Veterinary Technology Program Director, Dr. Jennifer Wells, DVM, Dog Abilities owner and trainer, Day Groden, and Patience for Cats founder and associate certified cat behavior consultant, Patience Fisher. Thank you all so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Ella Rowan. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.